From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. The new film, We Were Soldiers, starring Mel Gibson, is the story of one of the first big battles of the Vietnam War. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk to the two men who wrote the book on which the movie is based, General Harold Moore and journalist Joseph Galloway. Moore led the battle, and Galloway risked his life to cover it. They both say it was the worst fighting they've ever seen. Also, we'll meet the inventor of the Moog synthesizer, Dr. Robert Moog. He was just honored at this year's Grammys with a Technical Achievement Award. And Milo Miles has a review of Cowboy Bebop, a Japanese animation series that runs late night on the Cartoon Network. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush confirmed today that dozens of government officials are working to maintain a shadow government in secret locations outside Washington. The idea is to ensure that the government would be able to carry on even if there were a direct attack on the nation's capital. Speaking today in Iowa, the president said that his administration takes the issue of continuity of government very seriously. The plan for the shadow government was developed during the Cold War but never activated until the September 11th attacks. In response to sharp criticism from Republicans, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is standing by comments he made yesterday regarding the nation's military campaign against terrorism. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
It all started Thursday after Daschle told reporters that if Osama bin Laden is not brought to justice, quote, we will have failed. His Republican counterpart Trent Lott shot back that Daschle, quote, should not be trying to divide our country. House Majority Whip Tom DeLay called Daschle's comments disgusting. And now Daschle has come to his own defense.
I think the Republicans' reaction is nothing short of hysterical. I'm amused, frankly. I'd ask them to look at what I said, because I stand by what I said. The Congress has a constitutional responsibility to ask questions. We are not a rubber stamp to this president or to anybody else.
Other top Senate Democrats this week also began publicly questioning where the war on terrorism is headed. David Wellna, NPR News, the Capitol.
A giant pharmaceutical maker has dropped Arthur Anderson Company as its auditor. Merck & Company is the latest big client to leave Anderson following its role in the collapse of Enron. Merck had used Anderson as its auditor for more than 30 years. Psychiatrists have spent the day testifying on behalf of Andrea Yates. Yates has pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity in the drowning deaths of three of her five children. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports from Houston.
Defense attorney showed a 14-minute videotape of Andrea Yates taken last July, about 3 weeks after the murders. Yates was pale. She had dark circles under her eyes. She sat still in her chair. She answered questions without emotion. The video was taken by defense psychiatrist Dr. Philip Resnick, who conducted a mental evaluation. Yates told the psychiatrist that her five children were not developing right. She said that by taking the children in their innocent years, God would take them up to be in heaven. If not, they would continue sinning and go to hell. Resnick testified that although Yates thought she knew right from wrong, that it was her perception based on delusions and psychosis that caused her actions. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Houston.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 262 points to close at 10,368 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 71 points, or 4%. This is NPR News. NASA engineers are studying a cooling system problem that could interfere with the mission of the space shuttle Columbia. Shortly after Columbia reached orbit today, sensors revealed that the flow of coolant was reduced in one of the shuttle's cargo doors. The engineering team says that for now, the situation appears to be acceptable. Columbia is scheduled to rendezvous with the Hubble Space Telescope on Sunday, when it will begin a mission to upgrade the telescope with new parts and equipment. A space probe orbiting Mars has revealed a lot of water ice on the surface of the planet. The probe's beginning a mission to map the extent of frozen water and other intriguing features of Mars. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
there's a lot of evidence to suggest that Mars used to be wet. Giant canyons carved by liquid, signs of sedimentary rock, even hints of liquid seeps. But scientists have been frustrated in their attempts to measure water directly. The most promising experiment, Mars Observer, failed to enter Mars orbit in 1993. But now a spacecraft called the 2001 Mars Odyssey has beamed back an answer. Three separate instruments on the craft show that there's water ice in the first few feet of Martian soil, and lots of it across the southern part of the planet. And Mars Odyssey has just started to explore the planet, so it could find a lot more. The big question still is whether there is any liquid water, which would be necessary to support alien life. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
Consumer spending edged up in January. The Commerce Department said consumer spending rose by 0.4%, which is significant because consumer spending accounts for 2/3 of all the economic activity in the country. Personal incomes also rose by 0.4%. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods, on the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The new film, We Were Soldiers, is based on the 1992 bestseller We Were Soldiers Once and Young, Ia Drang, The Battle That Changed the War in Vietnam, by General Harold Moore and Joseph Galloway. Ia Drang was the first major land battle the Americans fought in Vietnam. It was also the bloodiest. Both sides claim victory. Both sides suffered tremendous losses. General Moore, who's played in the film by Mel Gibson, led the campaign. Joseph Galloway, who was a 23-year-old reporter at the time, covered the battle for UPI. General Moore led 450 men of the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, into the Ia Drang Valley. They never expected to be surrounded by 2,000 North Vietnamese soldiers. Reinforcements came from both sides. The battle ended with 230 Americans dead, 240 wounded, and 3,000 North Vietnamese dead. Terry Gross spoke to Harold Moore and Joseph Galloway in November of 1992 on the 27th anniversary of the battle. General Moore told Terry that the worst-case scenario happened early on in the battle when one of his platoons was cut off from the rest of the battalion.
That happened because we had a very aggressive lieutenant who was ordered to go up to the rest of the company through this scrub jungle and get on their flank and give them mutual support. In other words, tie in with them on their right flank. This lieutenant and his platoon encountered 3 to 4 North Vietnamese as they got to the rest of their company, and he ordered his men to take off after them, which they did. They got out 300 yards away from the rest of the company, away from everyone else, and were cut off, surrounded and cut off from the rest of the battalion.
What's your responsibility when that happens?
Quite simple. My responsibility was to try to get them back and get to them and keep them from being overrun. As it turned out, the platoon leader was killed within minutes. The next in command, the platoon sergeant, was killed. And command came down to a buck sergeant, 3 stripes, who took command of the platoon. And he formed them into a perimeter, brought in fire support, artillery and air, and we held this enemy off as we tried to attack to get to them. It took us over 24 hours to get to them. But when we got to them and rescued them, they still had ammunition with which to fight.
General, you weren't prepared for the size of the Vietnamese force that you faced. What were you prepared to find, and how many men were actually there against you?
Okay. About 10 minutes before we took off for the Ia Drang Valley in the initial assault, I received information that there were 3 battalions of enemy, and a battalion of North Vietnamese is around 500 men, that there were 3 battalions of the enemy within 2 miles of our landing zone. And so I sifted this through my head and immediately realized that we could be into a fight almost immediately upon landing, and which indeed we were. Within 45 minutes, we were in the first major battle of the war between a large American force and North Vietnamese forces. I say large because eventually I got 3 or 4 hours later, the rest of my battalion on the ground, but at first we only had 80 to 100. And it was a very, very sporty occasion, let me assure you.
Joe Galloway, I'm going to ask you to describe what it was like to be on the ground in the middle of a battle in which there was rocket fire, bombs, cannons, ground artillery.
This was shocking. This was overwhelming noise. You couldn't hear yourself think. The second morning, the enemy launched a major attack on the southeast side of this little football-sized clearing. And all of a sudden, this thunderous attack erupts. And we're right behind the company that's being hit. And the machine gun fire and the rifle fire and the rocket grenades of the enemy that pass through that company are landing on us. Men next to me fell over with a bullet in the head. I was lying down as close to the ground as I could get. Seemed like the right thing to do. When I felt the toe of a combat boot in my ribs, and I sort of turned my head and tilted up and looked, and it was the battalion sergeant major, a man 6 foot 3 inches tall, a big bear of a guy. And he bent over at the waist and sort of yelled down at me so I could just hear him. And what he said shocked me. He said, "Sonny, you can't take no pictures laying down there on the ground." And I thought about that for a minute, and I realized he's right. I can't do my job down here. And the other thing that crossed my mind is I think we're probably all going to be killed, and if that's the case, I'd just as soon take mine standing up anyway. So I got up and went about my business.
What did you shoot?
I was carrying a Nikon camera and an M16 rifle, and on occasion I used them both.
Did your pictures turn out from the battle?
The pictures were... For somebody who was as scared as I was, they weren't too bad.
General, when bombs are falling and there's artillery fire all around and you're under attack, this is the question of somebody who's never served or been in battle. But how do you think clearly? I mean, this is the time when you are most required to think clearly, but when it must be most difficult to do so.
I really have never had any problem. Thinking clearly in a tough, time-critical situation, I think I kind of go into a sort of a C-zone and blank out all the horrible brutality which is going on around me, being aware of it nevertheless, but realizing that I was a commander, I am a commander, and I am responsible for preserving as many American lives as I can and killing as many enemies as I can. Now, in the smoke and the dust, which limits visibility, and the terrible heat, that compounds the situation. The men screaming and yelling, giving orders in three languages, English, Spanish, Vietnamese, wounded men screaming for medics and for their mother about to die. I've never found it difficult to keep my head in situations like that. I'm a paratrooper. I've had a couple of malfunctions. Once I was 8 seconds from hitting the ground, but I knew I'd make it in on my reserve if I could get it open. So I've never really been concerned when I've been in a tough situation. Just do the job.
I guess you can't allow yourself to get too emotional about your men dying in the middle of a fight.
No, you cannot. And furthermore, you cannot impart by your very manner and your voice on the radio any possible sign or word or tone of voice that would indicate to any listener or any of your men looking at you that you were rattled. You had to look cool. And be cool. And it's something you can't put on.
What about when the battle's over and you don't have to be cool? And you don't have to be an emotional. Does it get you in a different way then?
Yep. That's when it's always hit me. In this battle, I looked around on the ground and saw many of my precious men in their ponchos lying dead, men whom I have trained for 18 months, knew their wives, children, many of them, knew them very closely. And I knew a terrible truth that 24 hours later would shatter the hearts of their families back home in America. And that got to me. Darn right it did. And I never a day goes by in the 27 years since that battle that I don't refight it in my mind and think about those great Americans who never backed off, many of them who had only 7 to 10 days left in the service. And they went home in coffins. And I'm forever grateful for their service, and I grieve for them forever. And for years, I felt guilty that I was not killed. I guess that's a normal reaction from a commander who loves his men.
You don't feel that way anymore?
I've kind of gotten over it a little bit. A few years back, several of my troopers told me at one of these reunions, they said, "Colonel," and they still call me Colonel, which is fine, "Colonel, you got to stop feeling that way, because if you died in that place, none of us would have got out of there." Well, I don't know if that's true or false, but that made me feel better.
Lieutenant General Harold Moore and Joseph Galloway, co-authors of the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young. The book has been adapted into the new film We Were Soldiers, starring Mel Gibson. We'll hear more of Terry Gross's 1992 interview with them after the break. This is Fresh Air. Now back to Terry Gross's interview with Lieutenant General Harold Moore and journalist Joseph Galloway. Their book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, is the basis for the new film We Were Soldiers, starring Mel Gibson.
Now, this battle lasted 4 days and 4 nights. Did you get any sleep at all, either of you, during the length of the battle?
I didn't get any sleep. Along about the early morning of the third day, my mind was still functioning clearly and cleanly and quickly. Do that on adrenaline or just on training and stamina. But the curious thing that happened was that I had to think every word before I would say it into the radio or to people around me. It was like translating English into English, if you can understand what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Joe, did you get any sleep, and were you functioning well?
Well, I was functioning. Sleep sort of leaves your mind. When I'd gone out to that tea plantation, I'd been on the perimeter with one of Colonel Moore's, his Bravo company. And that was foxholes and alarms all night and 100% alert, so I got no sleep that night, and I got no sleep the next night. And I think it was on the last night we were in there, somewhere about 2 o'clock in the morning, it kind of caught up with me. And I remember leaning back against a tree, and the last thing I remember for about an hour and a half until the shooting started again was I remember that same fellow who booted me up onto my feet in the middle of the firestorm. I remember him kneeling down, the sergeant major, and putting a poncho liner over me and tucking me in like I was his son or his grandchild. And I thought, what a tender gesture from such a tough man. And I did. I just conked out. I slept for a couple of hours. I was awakened by the renewed fighting and came up out of the poncho liner and went back to work. Some of that work, I would say, you're not so much a news person in those circumstances as you are of another set of hands.
Mm-hmm.
You can be of use. You can carry the wounded. You can bring water. You can carry ammunition.
Did you carry the wounded?
I did. The one memory that will never leave my mind is what they call a friendly fire incident that occurred on the second day. And we were around the command post, and someone said, "My God, look." And I looked up, and there were two canisters of napalm that had just been released by a U.S. Air Force F-100 jet. And they were coming directly at us. And his wingman was behind him and alongside. And if the first set of napalm cans didn't get us, the second were surely going to. And I can remember Colonel Moore screaming, "Get him to pull up, pull up, pull up." And the Charlie Hastings, the Air Force forward controller, on the radio screaming at that pilot. The damage was done with the first two, but we could maybe stop the second plane from dropping his, and Charlie managed to do that. But the other two, just like slow motion, coming down at us, the officer next to me, he knew something I didn't know, that if you are caught in napalm, the one thing you need to do is protect your eyes. And he turned and he put his face into my shoulder and protected his eyes while I just watched them come. And they went just directly over our heads. And they struck in the middle of a couple of small foxholes where our engineer detachment were dug in the grass. And the napalm engulfed them, and we could see them dancing in the fire. And as soon as that napalm died down and we could run out into that smoldering grass, we did. And a man loomed up in the smoke, and he said, "Get this man by his feet." And I reached, and I caught his ankles. And when I did, the nylon of the combat boots crumbled in my hands, and the flesh came off, and I could feel the bones of his ankles in the palms of my hands. And you never ever forget something like that. Those men lay for an hour or so in our little makeshift aid station right beside us, screaming in pain in spite of all the morphine in the world. This affects you. You're no longer you can't be a detached observer in those circumstances. These are people who are giving their lives to save yours.
I'd like to ask you both if during the battle, when you probably thought there was a good chance you would die, if you made any bargains with God or made any promises about what you would do if you did live.
I did not. I was very young at the time, just turned 24. I had thought about this myself, and I thought this is a possibility. But I'd have no wife, I have no children. This is my life I'm risking, and it would cause some pain to my mother and father, but it's worth the risk. Now, I went to war again when I was 49 years old, and I rode with the tanks of the 24th Infantry Division into the Euphrates River Valley, deep in Iraq. And that was different. I'm married. I have two young sons, 12 and 15. And all the way across that desert, I thought about them. And I thought about, once again, the young men who were riding with me. And I did do some talking to God on that ride. And what I said was, "God, don't send me back into another Iadrang Valley. I've been there, and these kids don't need to see that."
General, let me ask you if you ever made any bargains with God when you were thinking that this might be the end.
No. You got to remember now that I was a West Point graduate, professional Army officer, trained in all the Army schools. I'd been through battle in the Korean War as a infantry company commander of two infantry companies. And I'd seen battle before, and in that war and in the Vietnam War, I never did any bargaining with God. I never thought about my wife and five kids back in America. The thing I thought about was my troopers on the ground and accomplishing my mission, and I never gave a thought in any fight I've ever been in two wars, whether or not I'd get hit. If I got hit, I got hit. That's it. My job was to lead troops, and to lead them, you got to be on the battlefield, and you cannot be fearful. You got to keep your cool, and I never knelt down. It never crossed my mind that we would go down in that fight against great odds. I knew in my heart that we would prevail. We had massive fire support. We had disciplined troops, and we were tough, and we were good. And it never entered my mind to make a personal bargain with God for me or for my men. I knew we'd win. I lost 79 killed and 121 men wounded, including my attached units, and that's a terrible price to pay. But he did not kill us all, as he obviously intended to do.
Do you, either of you, do anything special on the anniversary of the battle every year?
Oh, you bet. All of the people that we have interviewed in this book, all our friends, our brothers, our comrades, as many of them as possible come here to Washington, and we have a reunion, we have a dinner, we go together to the wall. The names of those who fell in the battles in the Yidrang, 305 of them, are engraved on one single granite panel, the third one to the right of the apex of the Vietnam Memorial. We're older, and some of us are beat up and got gimpy legs, and some of them don't have arms, and some of them are half blind. But we come and we go say something in our hearts to those we left behind.
And let me tell you, it's a pretty heavy, very profound experience to do so when you see those names on that wall that you knew so well when they were in the prime of their youth, soldiers once and young, and it's tough, but it's also healing, and it's good to be there.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Joseph Galloway and Lieutenant General Harold Moore. They co-wrote the bestseller We Were Soldiers Once and Young, Yidrang, the Battle That Changed the War in Vietnam. The book is out in paperback. Terry Gross spoke with Moore and Galloway in November 1992 on the 27th anniversary of the battle. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Crow Lake, a novel of sibling relationships by debut author Mary Lawson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a demonstration of the Moog and the theremin from electronic music pioneer Robert Moog. He's just been honored with a Technical Achievement Award at this year's Grammys. Also, Cowboy Bebop, an animated series from Japan that airs long after the kids have gone to bed. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. This week, Robert Moog, creator of the first music synthesizer, won the 2002 Technical Grammy, an award which recognizes contributions of outstanding technical significance to the recording field. Electronic music is so pervasive now, we take it for granted. But it was a new concept in the mid-60s when Robert Moog invented the Moog synthesizer, which generated sounds electronically. It caught on in all forms of music, from the avant-garde to rock and novelty. The synthesizer became more accessible to musicians and composers after Moog made his first portable, the Mini Moog, in the early 70s. Robert Moog lives in Asheville, North Carolina, where he heads his company, Big Briar, which manufactures Moogs and theremins, the eerie-sounding instrument that has been used in many science fiction films. When Terry spoke with Robert Moog 2 years ago, he brought a Mini Moog to the studio with him. Terry asked him for a demonstration.
Okay, so here's a plain sound. This is a pure electronic pitch. Now I'll frequency modulate it. By that I mean that I will vary the pitch of its tone periodically. So most people would say that was a different sound than just this. Now I can speed up and slow down the modulation. Or make it a different shape. Here's what we call a square wave. It makes the tone sound like a trill. So that's just one example of how we can use one electronic circuit to periodically even aperiodically change the operation of another one and make musically interesting sounds in the boot and in the process.
Now, regular instruments, acoustic instruments, operate through physically doing something to the instrument. You pound it, you press it, strum it, bow it, blow air into it. Compare that with the principles of an electronic music instrument like the Moog.
The energy to make the sound is there. It comes out of the wall.
So electricity. The sound,
yes. So the what I'm doing is controlling the sound. It's as if I'm driving a car rather than pulling a wagon. I'm steering the sound with my hands.
So what you're doing is actually changing the shape of the sound wave as opposed to pressing on a drum, pounding on a drum or something.
That's right.
And so your knobs allow you to just change the shape of a sound wave.
Yes.
The amplitude, the shape
and
of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we can increase the complexity of the sound. For instance, there's one tone. Now we can add a second tone. Here's one, the other, together. They form a richer third tone. So we can add sounds and waveforms together. We can use one waveform to shape what we hear from another circuit. And we can also filter out the overtones, the harmonics that are made by these waveforms.
You want to give me an example of that?
Here's, let's get a brighter sound. There. This is called a low-pass filter. Originally, it was a technical term, but musicians these days, at least ones who plug in, understand what that means. So I'll close the filter, and we'll cut out first the higher overtones and then all of them. Now, when I vary the filter slowly like that, you can hear what's happening, that the sound is getting more mellow and less bright as I turn down the knob here labeled cutoff frequency. But if instead of my turning the knob, I use a waveform that goes up and then down every time I hit a key, we'll get a sound like this. Now, that opening and closing of the filter was done not by me, but by the envelope generator. Now, I'll make it faster, and you'll see what effect that has on the sound. And still faster. Now, that happened so fast that if I had to do that with my hand, I couldn't possibly, because my hand can't move that fast. But electronics can move that fast. So now I have a different sort of sound. I have a plucked string-like sound. Because I've set up a sound here that's bright and with lots of harmonics at the beginning, and then within, say, 30 or 40 thousandths of a second, it dies down, and our ear identifies that as a string-like sound.
Other records from the 60s, when you were first, in the early 70s, when the Moog was first catching on, that you think sound almost embarrassingly dated today?
Well, you know, the first use of Moog synthesizer on the West Coast sounds embarrassingly dated. It's a record called Zodiac Cosmic Sound.
How can that not sound dated?
Well, what happened is, this was in 1967, and we were wondering whether we could stay in business because, we weren't making any money, and nobody understood our products. We were invited to exhibit our new synthesizers out at the Audio Engineering Society in the West Coast. So at that exhibit, we were then invited to bring this one instrument that nobody had ever seen out there to a recording session of Zodiac Cosmic Sounds. And the synthesizer was used to make some distinctly novel electronic effects, one of which begins the album. But what the album is, it starts off with very conventional sounding Hollywood movie music. It was a mono record too. Imagine how dated that is now. It was 1967. Was a mono record. So it starts off that way, and then with a low organ tone, the narrator comes on. He had a voice as deep as crude oil, and he said, "Nine times the color red explodes like heated blood. The battle's on." Then ba 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 ba, like that. The producers at the time were very impressed with themselves about how in this was and how hip and how many they were going to sell. Now when you play it, people just break out laughing.
So is the bum-ba-bums that you were doing on the synthesizer?
No. They were done more or less conventionally.
Where did the synthesizer come in?
The synthesizer came in making just drop-in sounds. Let's see if I can set one up. The Mini Moog is really not big enough to do all the sounds that we did, but let's, for instance, start with one sound. We'll add another sound. Okay, so that's about a whole tone apart. I'll add a third sound. That's the general sort of sound that they liked. And then we just glide up a little bit here. That sort of sound.
Great. Yeah.
Now, with the large synthesizer that we had back then, at the studio in Los Angeles, you could glide more slowly, you could add more frequencies, you could make a sound that was fairly striking for those times.
My guest is Robert Moog. He's the creator of the Moog synthesizer, and a pioneer of electronic instruments. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Moog, a pioneer of electronic instruments, creator of the Moog synthesizer. What are the early records, the first records that you think really helped the Moog synthesizer catch on?
The biggie was Switched on Bach. Mm-hmm. In light of that, everything else pales. Switched on Bach came out at the end of 1968. I can remember playing a cut from it at an Audio Engineering Society convention in New York City, about a month in advance of its release. And I can remember all those cynical, experienced recording engineers listening to this and being so overjoyed that a piece of work so innovative and of such high quality was being done that they gave Carl Wallace a standing ovation.
Did you like Switched on Bach?
Oh, yes. Yes, in fact, I visited Carwell several times while Carwell and his associates were working on the piece, and I was just bowled over every time I came. Something new was there to be heard.
Well, why don't we hear some music from Switched on Bach? And it was Walter Carlos back
yes.
then, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is Walter Carlos at the Moog synthesizer. That's Walter Carlos playing Switched on Bach, the record that helped really establish commercially the Moog synthesizer. My guest is Robert Moog, the creator of the Moog synthesizer and the related synthesizers that he's since created. He's a pioneer of electronic instruments. Is there a kind of retro thing going on now in music where people are looking for vintage Moog synthesizers, the early ones that you designed and built?
Yes, the market for instruments of ours that were made in the 60s and 70s is rapidly rising. Of course, the supply is limited. Approximately 12,000 mini Moogs were made over a 10-year period, and maybe one-tenth that many modular systems were made, and they're all very highly prized now. 10 years ago, they wouldn't have been that highly prized because people were more focused on the new bells and whistles coming out of digital technology. But you know, fashions change, people's tastes are capricious, and now there is the emerging realization that, yes, these sounds are musically good, and yes, these instruments are fun to play.
What can the early instruments do that the new ones can't?
A typical digital instrument doesn't have a panel full of knobs. A typical digital instrument has a few buttons that you can enter numbers with and then store those numbers. And if you want to be analytical and precise, that's an interesting way of setting up a complex sound the way you want it. However, if you just want to play it, to reach out and change one part of it spontaneously, you really can't do that by incrementing numbers. You need to be able to have something to put your fingers on right then in a small fraction of a second, turn the knob, turn the switch, and change the sound. So that's one thing. The other thing is that these sounds, you can emulate them by digital means. You can come close. There are digital emulations of the Mini Moog, for instance, now that are on sale, so that you can can turn the screen of your computer, of your home computer, into a control panel of the Mini Moog. But however, the sounds that it produces to a musician with experienced ears doesn't sound as good as the real thing.
When you created the first Moog synthesizer, was it out of an interest in electronics or music or both?
I had been building electronic musical instruments since I was a kid. It was always a hobby of mine, and I always approached it as an electronics person, somebody who liked to work with a soldering iron and a pair of pliers, who also had some musical training. By the time I got to building synthesizers, I had perhaps 20 years experience building electronic musical instruments.
Oh, I know you built theremins, and we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. What else did you build?
Well, back in the 40s and early 50s, building simple electronic projects was a popular hobby for many people. Back then, you could buy a few parts and with tubes and build something on your kitchen table, and it would actually work. So there were magazines describing all sorts of hobby projects, and I can remember building one-note organs, two-note organs, radios, phonograph, amplifiers. And that was my life. That's what I did back then. Other kids went out and beat each other up or played baseball, and I built electronics.
I think your father was an amateur radio operator?
Yes, he was. He was a professional engineer. He worked for Consolidated Edison in New York City.
That's the electric company.
Yes, it is. He worked for them all his life, and he was also an amateur radio operator.
So this is ham radio?
Yes.
So do you think your father's ham radio stuff had an impact on you?
Why, sure. He was the one who taught me how to do electronics. He taught me how to use a soldering iron. My father had a very complete hobby basement with machine tools and all sorts of electronic stuff. I used to love to go down and just be with him and work with him.
It was a real guy thing for you?
I think so, yeah. It was a dad and son thing.
Did mom ever go down to the basement?
No. No, mom had the rest of the house.
Now, before you started inventing your own instruments, you built theremins. So let's start with what a theremin is. You've brought one with you. I imagine this is one that you've built.
Yes, it is. Well, it's one that my company built.
Right. That's good enough.
Close enough.
Give us a taste of the basic sound of the theremin. Our listeners will recognize it from lots of science fiction movies.
Okay, let me describe what I'm doing. I'm not touching the instrument when I'm playing it now. I'm moving my hands around it to control the volume and the pitch of the sound. I'll just make a very quick sound, and then maybe later I can actually try and play a melody. So when you wave your hands around a theremin, that's the sort of sound you get. It's not particularly musical, but it certainly sounds different from a piano or even a synthesizer. A theremin is an electronic musical instrument with two metal antennas. One is a vertical rod on the right-hand side of the instrument. The closer you get your right hand to that rod, the higher the pitch goes. So if you imagine a violin string in the air between your shoulder and the pitch antenna, and by moving my hand along that string, you can imagine the sort of gestures I make.
But it's an imaginary string.
It's an imaginary string. I'm not touching anything when I play. On the left hand of the instrument, there is a loop, a metal loop, which controls the volume. The closer I get my hand to that loop, the softer the sound gets. So my gestures consist of moving my right hand back and forth from my right shoulder to the pitch antenna to make the notes, and moving my left hand up and down as if I'm conducting an imaginary orchestra out there to control the volume and articulate the sound.
Would you play us a science fiction effect on the theremin? You could even play something from one of the movies that the theremin, one of the movies, scores that the theremin was used in.
A science fiction effect. I'll try.
And do you get that little vibrato by wiggling your hand back and forth?
Yes. I move my right hand from my wrist rapidly back and forth, just as a violinist does.
Would you like to leave us with some music on the Moog synthesizer?
Let's see. Well, that's some music. I don't know how much, but it's some.
Robert Moog, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to have the opportunity.
Robert Moog recorded in 2000. He received a Lifetime Achievement Award for Technical Innovation at this year's Grammys. Coming up, Cowboy Bebop from Japan. This is Fresh Air.
Adults who like to watch cartoons are tuning into the late night block on the Cartoon Network. One adventure series from Japan, called Cowboy Bebop, has caught on with fans of anime, the Japanese name for cartoons. Cowboy Bebop is shown on Saturday nights at 11:30. It first appeared in Japan in 1998. Critic Milo Miles says there are lots of reasons to like Cowboy Bebop.
I think it's time to blow this scene. Get everybody in the stuff together. Okay, 3, 2, 1, let's jam.
If you like James Bond, the movie Blade Runner, old Flash Gordon comic strips, or Japanese sci-fi animation like Akira, Cowboy Bebop is designed for you. In fact, this cartoon series seems to be reaching for so many different styles and moods, there's no way it can avoid becoming just another postmodern mess. But it's remarkably unified. And once you pick up its rhythms, clear and easy to follow, especially considering how notoriously intricate Japanese anime can be. Director Shinichiro Watanabe and head writer Keiko Nobumoto's basic premise is that you're watching a TV adventure show from 100 years in the future. The heroes are a pair of interplanetary bounty hunters, young martial arts ace Spike Spiegel and the older ex-cop Jet Black. The first few episodes add main characters. These include the shady young lady Faye Valentine, who becomes a bounty hunter to support her gambling habit, and the hyperactive 13-year-old girl computer hacker named Ed. Then the show simply runs riffs on the various outrageous criminals the bounty hunters try and usually fail to snare. space mafia types, ecology terrorists, alien drug smugglers. Toward the end of the 26 Cowboy Bebop episodes, the focus shifts towards the dark secret in each of the main characters' past. Simple enough premise at work, but Cowboy Bebop is rich with pace and panache. Our multimedia quick-cut world has conditioned everyone to be ready for switches from Wild West shootout to urban chase scene to outer space rocket duels. The characters romp through scenes that look like a combination of Disney with guts and Lucas with brains. And it can't be emphasized enough how soaked in music the show is. The norm for anime is ponderous synthesizer rock left over from the 70s or sickly sweet pop ballads. But on Cowboy Bebop, the music is crisp and adroit. Most of it is written by Yoko Kanno and performed by the group Seatbelts, with occasional guest stars like jazz drummer Bobby Previtt. Kanno has done video game soundtracks and is renowned among anime insiders for the music to the TV series Macross Plus. But Cowboy Bebop shows off her boldest, most intelligent work. The theme, called Tank, suggests a re-energized James Bond number, but the sly, idiomatic references to rock, blues, country, and especially funky jazz best suit the series' simmering party atmosphere. Cowboy Bebop is available as 6 individual VHS tapes or DVDs, or as box sets. The DVDs add a few charming features such as trailers, music videos, and interviews with the creators in the studio. The discs also include both English and Japanese versions, which is sometimes crucial because of careless dubbing. In this case, it merely points up what meticulous care was taken with the whole series. In English or Japanese, Cowboy Bebop has bulletproof cool.
Milo Miles is a music critic living in Cambridge. Cowboy Bebop is shown on the Cartoon Network on Saturday nights at 11:30 and is available on DVD. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Robots in Our Future, we'll talk with Rodney Brooks. He's the director of MIT's Artificial Intelligence Lab. His new book is Flesh and Machines: How Robots Will Change Us. Join us for the next Fresh Air.